So if you walk into a room and nobody's saying that the emperor has no clothes, you think you're the only person who realizes it. And so maybe you second guess yourself, whatever, because you're reading the room. Human beings are tribal animals. You feel that like there's a social consensus about this and that you're way on the outside of it. But if you go into the room and you know there's a big sign up from the government that says nobody's allowed to say the emperor has no clothes, then you're like, okay, so probably we all know this, but we're just not allowed to say it. And at least then you're grounded in reality. But when the government tampered with what was able to be posted but wasn't open about doing that, I believe that really confused us. It created a false sense of social consensus. And that, I think, is worse. It's like a warped sense of reality that many of us were going through.
Dr. Chloe Carmichael, thank you for joining me on the podcast today.
Thanks, Les. Great to be with you.
I have to say, you are a breath of fresh air. I have been watching some of your recent stuff to gear up for this, and I feel like you're doing really important work. Like, you're giving a voice to people that I think have, to a lot of people, including myself, that on some level have been living in silence out of fear. And it's fascinating that you got there through clinical psychology, and I'm sure we'll learn what led you into that too. But first, I just want to say thanks, and I'm grateful that you're out there spreading this message, and I'm honored to be a conduit for it.
Thank you so much. In case anyone is like wondering, like, what is this message? It's the fact that as a clinical psychologist, I believe that free speech is good for mental health. And I want to thank you for that, Les, for, as you said, being a conduit, because it's been a surprisingly difficult message to amplify. You know, prior to this book, I was, you know, called by CNN and, you know, quoted in the New York Times and, you know, pretty, you know, good ABC, Nightline, that kind of stuff. And I had a big publisher for my previous book and a fancy literary agent. And all of that went away when I wanted to do this book. It's opened up other doors, but it's closed a lot of doors because for whatever reason, the idea of free speech feels controversial to people. So I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to try to share with people like what I think is a pretty basic message from psychologists usually, which is that it's a good thing to speak your mind.
Right. Yeah. Typically, it is thought of very good. But I guess over the last 5 years or so, you know, through COVID, that idea got attacked, I guess.
Yeah, I think it became, you know, polarized. And there's a chapter in the book, which is called Can I Say That? Why Free Speech Matters and How to Use It Fearlessly. And there is a chapter called Common Objections to Free Speech. And to your point, over the past 5 years, some of these objections to free speech have arisen. One of them is, you know, well, what about misinformation? Or what about hate speech and bullying? And in the past 5 years, I do think that those concerns have sometimes been raised legitimately, and they've sometimes been raised as power plays, so that if, you know, powers that be don't like what you're saying, then they can label it as hate speech or label it as misinformation or whatever the case may be. So I think some of it actually has to do with power and control.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right. And it's funny, I know that there was a lot of like censorship through the social media platforms, but it's like the people that were consuming content from people that got censored or the people that were getting censored were the only people that knew. Because if it was being censored, and you sided with, let's say, the political side that was maybe mainly responsible for it, you didn't even know. It wasn't even something you believed was going on.
Right. Yeah. And I think you're raising a really important point there, because there's two kinds of censorship. There's self-censorship, which is where, you know, nobody's like making me, but yet I'm just concerned about social pressure. And so I censor myself, which I'm happy to talk about my own history of doing that quite a lot. And then I reached a breaking point. And that was, you know, what prompted me in some ways to write this book. And then there's the other side, which is, you know, top-down government censorship, where, you know, you want to speak up, but yet if you do, you're literally going to be, you know, jailed or deplatformed or whatever. And what happened on social media was, I think, particularly nefarious and insidious and harmful to our mental health, because it wasn't even up front. And many people still may not even know this. So in case anyone doesn't know this yet, and, you know, feel free to Google this. It's just, it's actually very common information now. The executives like Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, the executives of Meta, so Facebook and Instagram, and the executives of YouTube, as well as Jack Dorsey, the original founder of Twitter, and of course, Elon Musk, all of these people have now come forward and explicitly acknowledged that the government, specifically the Biden administration, was pressuring them behind closed doors secretly to take down, deplatform, dethrottle, censor things that that administration didn't like, things oftentimes to do with COVID or trans issues. And as a clinical psychologist, obviously, I think government censorship has harms, but it's almost worse when the government at the time was telling everybody, no, no, there's no censorship, but then they were secretly doing it. Because what that did is it tampered with the public's sense of social consensus, with our ability to read the room. So if you walk into a room and nobody's saying that the emperor has no clothes, you think you're the only person who realizes it. And so maybe you second guess yourself, whatever, because you're reading the room. Human beings are tribal animals. You feel that like there's a social consensus about this and that you're way on the outside of it. But if you go into the room and you know there's a big sign up from the government that says nobody's allowed to say the emperor has no clothes, then you're like, okay, so probably we all know this, but we're just not allowed to say it. And at least then you're grounded in reality. But when the government tampered with what was able to be posted but wasn't open about doing that, I believe that really confused us. It created a false sense of social consensus. And that, I think, is worse. It's like a warped sense of reality that many of us were going through.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And it sounds like a really important aspect of that. Like, I bet there's other countries with, like, dictatorships that are very clear. Like, you're not allowed to say this.
Mm-hmm. At least they're honest about it.
Yeah, at least they're Yeah, it's like they're honest about having their finger on the scale.
Yeah, yeah. And so, I mean, there's something we can, you know, get into it as time goes on here. I know we have plenty of time, but when you mess with a person's sense of reality, they can start second guessing themselves. We can start feeling like, you know, we have to adjust our own thoughts to fit, you know, what we think everybody else is regarding as common sense. So there's that self-censorship, and then there's the government censorship. And then what happened during COVID with the secret censorship from the government, I think that really messed with people in ways that we're just now coming out of, which I am glad to say on a positive side. I think people are starting to speak up more and more, which as a psychologist, I fully support. Even if I disagree with them, I don't want to cut out their tongue. I want people to be able to say what they think, feel, and believe.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, I'm guilty of it. I mean, I remember I've always been, I mean, just in general, I'm strongly opinionated. And I have some insights of like where I got that from coming out of childhood, but, and maybe why that served me at some point, but as adult doesn't serve me as well. But on the podcast, I've never been one to express my opinions about anything that is like political or whatever, because partly was because, I just felt like it wasn't a good place for conversation. So like the comment section is just a cesspool anytime there's anything that's like any polarizing topic. And I just didn't want to engage with that. It just didn't seem mentally healthy for me to devote time and energy to that, you know, to the combative stuff. But primarily it's because it was like fear. Like, I don't want to get canceled. Like, this channel was started by my wife and she put so much work into it. And it got to a point where it's a significant part of, like, you know, how we pay our bills. And it's like, I felt that it would be like, I would like be dishonored. Like, I couldn't live with the guilt if something happened to the whole channel because of something I said. So that was maybe even more of the fact why I just wouldn't talk about stuff, even though, like, I felt strongly about things. And I know I'm not alone, you know?
Yeah, totally.
I would like to take a moment and talk about something very near and dear to my heart. It's coffee. Sometimes at night, I think about the countdown to coffee time. This may sound strange, but this is me just being real. Starting my day with coffee always provides the uplifting mood I desire to tackle whatever is ahead. But honestly, sometimes with the increased energy and focus, it can be accompanied with a bit of jitters. I could in theory drink less, but come on now, let's not get carried away. Thankfully, there's Everyday Dose, coffee with benefits. Everyday Dose combines coffee with collagen, natural nootropics, and theanine to help smooth everything out for you. Get the boost you need to accomplish your New Year's resolutions. Lion's Mane helps with natural focus, while L-theanine keeps the stress at bay. Everyday Dose is the perfect boost you need to accomplish your New Year. Right now, get 61% off your first Coffee Plus starter kit, free peppermint mocha creamer plus, and over $100 in free gifts. Plus, enter for a chance to win $100 cash or get your entire order refunded. Visit everydaydose.com/mindful or use code mindful at checkout. Chronological age represents your birthday, but your biological age is really how old your body is. Biological age is the strongest predictor of disease risk and mortality. I think this is great news because we can turn the dials of lifestyle and heavily influence our health outcomes. TrueAge offers an easy at-home test kit to provide you with everything you need to know about your biological age and what steps you can take to optimize for your health goals. I've taken the test twice now, and it couldn't be more convenient, and the information it delivers is first rate. You can order online, and the kit ships right to your door. It's a quick, simple finger prick at home, then drop it in the prepaid return package. Your only job? Follow the 3 recommendations for 90 days, then retest to see progress. It uses advanced epigenetic testing to analyze over 1 million biomarkers. TrueAge identifies the 3 most important actions you can take over 90 days to improve your health. It's trusted by longevity clinics and health professionals, not just consumers at home. Right now, my listeners can get 20% off at truediagnostic.com using code MINDFUL20 at checkout. That's truediagnostic.com and use code MINDFUL20 for 20% off today. Choose TrueAge, True Health, or the Combo Kit as a one-time purchase or subscription.
I mean, so you're raising some, I think, really interesting points. I'm just writing down some things that you're saying because I think you're saying a lot there. So a lot of people say that they don't want to, you know, wade into anything political. And I can totally understand that, especially if it's, you know, talking about a specific candidate or whatever that feels very on the nose political. However, the thing is that if we look at the root of the word political, it really, at its root, it just means public life. It means our shared political, our community. And so that has to do with the laws that govern us. It has to do with what our children are going to be taught in school. It has to do with the way that crime is going to be handled in our neighborhoods. It has to do with all kinds of healthcare questions that you know, affect us and that affect our children and all kinds of other things. And so one of the things that I shared in the book is I named off, you know, there's this Pew Research poll. And so basically everything from like abortion to immigration to crime and, you know, other things too, basically everybody cares about one or two of those issues. Not everybody cares about all those issues, but everybody cares about at least one or two of those issues. So even if we don't feel like we want to be, quote, political, at the same time, if we notice and care at all about our society, we all want to say, well, I'm a contributing member to society. I'm a good community member, right? So that means being somewhat involved and invested in the rules and the policies that we all agree to live by. I just think being political has kind of a lot of baggage attached to it. But if we think about it more as just being like conscious of our community and being stakeholders in the conversations and the norms and the beliefs that are okay to share and to discuss and express, I mean, hopefully that feels more palatable to people.
Absolutely. I mean, honestly, that feels like a really beautiful message. I mean, I feel like as a society, we should want that message delivered in like the public school system at young age to get people feeling comfortable and understanding how it is essentially serving. It's like a sense of, it's almost like a sense of service on that level to your community by being open.
Yeah. And then I don't want to lose track of something else that you said there, which, and I think a lot of people, myself included, felt this way, is a fear of retaliation within our livelihood. If we should happen to say something, you know, that some people don't like, you know, like I said, I suffered a lot in terms of, you know, various media connections and things like that. And to be honest, if it weren't for the fact that my husband is an amazing provider for our family, I probably wouldn't have had the courage to even do this, because my income has definitely gone down since I started speaking up. But that's okay, because I have felt a lot better. Just, you know, mentally, there's cognitive, emotional, and social benefits, to speaking your mind and to being authentic. But at the same time, yeah, like, especially when people get in their minds these ideas like, you know, words are violence, or, you know, you're threatening my existence, or if you have a different opinion about, you know, immigration or food stamps or whatever, then you're a bigot and you're basically a Nazi. When people start going down into that road, I think it does, it's intimidation. And that's the thing too, is I don't think that everybody who does that means to be intimidating. I don't think they want to be intimidating. I don't think they want to intimidate people into silence. I don't think they like to think of themselves that way. Ironically, I think that they're doing a lot of that stuff out of a desire in their own minds to be compassionate, to rid the world of hate, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so my part of the message I have is to invite people to realize that if you cut people off, and I get into this in the book, it's called the 5 D's, defriending in real life, disinviting a speaker, dropping or decreasing contact in real life, or declining to date across the aisle. Those are all forms of social hostilities. And that when we do that to people because we don't like, you know, their political opinions, we're actually escalating tensions. Because as a clinical psychologist, I can tell you that violence increases when dialogue ceases. Even the worst people, like true actual KKK members and jihadi recruiters, the way that they change is not by someone telling them, shut up, we won't talk to you here. It's by somebody that reasons with them, that somehow has a dialogue with them. Not that it's all of our responsibilities to go dialogue with KKK members, but can we at least dialogue with people that see immigration differently or see abortion differently? Like, do we have to start cutting off our friends and family members over that, you know, especially ironically in the name of kindness, you know?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And dialogue is what's required to allow people to learn from each other and see maybe where they, because people change their mind about things over time. And you need dialogue for that to happen within the like social soup, so that the best ideas that are best for everybody wind up kind of floating to the top. It's interesting too, like the important topics that are so charging, it's like these are the things that need the most dialogue. they have the most gray area. Like if you talk about abortion, people are very strongly opinionated about that, and it's very polarizing, and which is fine and understandable. And also, it's like it also, because it's so important, it demands the deepest conversation. And part of that is trying to understand why people that feel differently feel differently. And one thing I've noticed is people generally think that they know why someone feels differently than them, but they're wrong. It's like people that are like, let's say, very pro-choice or whatever, they think they know why people that are pro-life. But if you talk to people that are pro-life and they tell you why they're pro-life, it's never for the reason that the pro-choice people feel, and vice versa. And it's like, what's like, but the things that should have the longest, deepest, most nuanced conversation have the least amount, because it gets so black and white and tribal, and you're either on my side or you're against. It's really unfortunate that, like, things that don't matter, people are very comfortable probably talking at length for with people that disagree with. Like, I love talking about things that are really, really important. I honestly just don't do it on the podcast for said reasons, generally. Maybe that'll change after meeting you. But it's just something I've observed. I find myself... I live in an area that's, would be considered like very liberal thinking, very left or whatever. And I went on a camping trip a couple of times in an area in Pennsylvania that is like the polar opposite. And at this campground, I met all these wonderful people. And, you know, even like that was being judged by the car I pulled in with. And I was there for 6 days. I wound up having these like great conversations with these people. And there were multiple times where they were kind of floored that I wasn't behaving the way they expected me to. But I also feel like if you put me in like a very liberal area, they'll probably think I'm like the most conservative person, and I'll fight every side. Like I'm just kind of like, I guess I'm like, there's part of me that's like the devil's advocate that just always wants to like, are you sure? And ask questions and be curious. And like try to hold a mirror up for somebody, and maybe there's part of me that just enjoys confrontation, and I'm also just like a cynic of all the political sides, like I think they're all full of shit.
Yeah, no, that's totally fair. And I mean, it's ironic, but like it's hard to be an independent or a centrist or to be like, well, I'm kind of left on one issue and right on another. You use the word tribalism, and it does feel like that's become active. You also said something important, I think, which is you said, you know, people can change their minds. And that is so powerful. And that's one of the incredible gifts of language. So I mentioned there's three primary areas of language's gifts, which are cognitive, emotional, and social. And on the cognitive side, when we put our interior life into words, into a system of language, it's really quite profound. It's almost like breathing in the sense that it's very profound and quite essential, actually, to our existence. But yet we don't think about it because we just do it all day long automatically. Same thing with speech. We have specific regions of our brain that are specifically devoted to the comprehension and to the production of language. It is truly one of our hardwired functions and capabilities, and also needs for survival. The psycholinguist Steven Pinker has said that humans need to speak the way spiders need to spin webs. It's essential to our functioning. And so when we take that internal life and we put it into words, we get a healthy separation, a distance, just as you know with mindfulness. When you observe your thoughts and then you put them into words, it gives you a healthy detachment. You're converting your internal life into an object, words, that you can become rational about and examine and evaluate. We can start applying logic, if-then type statements and develop ideas and also have distance to discard bad ideas. Like, haven't we all said something aloud and been like, you know what, as I say that aloud, I realize that doesn't make any sense, right? So people do and can change their minds. And yet somehow that's become this big taboo that you're supposed to just have your opinion and, you know, not change it. And something that I think can be helpful, just a technique from the book I want to share about that, about changing your mind, is that if you're talking to somebody, if you're in one of those heated conversations, and maybe you're the one getting heated because this person is saying a bunch of stuff that, you know, you think is, you know, triggering for you. One of the techniques that I've done is to, when I'm in that situation getting triggered by what someone else is saying, is to remember back to a time in my own life when I have held a completely different opinion that I now regard as almost a little cringy. Like, you know, my 17, 18, 19-year-old self, I, you know, had some pretty strong social and political opinions, and I was really, to be honest, kind of arrogant about them. And I don't even agree with those opinions anymore. But I have memories of myself almost yelling at people. Like, and so anyway, I flash back to those memories of myself. And then I forgive myself for being kind of over the top and vexing. And then I transfer that grace to the person in front of me that is now kind of being that girl, so to speak, at least in my mind. So I call that exercise, you know, transferring the grace. And there's a lot of exercise, I have to say. There's, like, I think over 24 exercises in the book for speaking up as well as for listening respectfully, because both are so important when it comes to healthy dialogue. We have to speak up and we have to know how to listen.
That sounds like a really important discipline. I mean, just to be able to be that self-reflective. I've made some progress doing things like that over the years, but it's definitely been challenging for me. I find that when you're in the moment, it's really hard for some people. And some people are just better at flexing that muscle. I don't know if that just stems from, you know, my guess, probably different childhood experiences where they've developed personality traits that served them, that they needed, that malfunction in a way or backfire as an adult when you're trying to interact socially. But can you touch on maybe another exercise about, yeah, like that you just alluded to about like listening or
yeah,
whatever?
Yeah, I was just thinking
those are really
one.
Useful like tools.
Yeah. So, I mean, to your point, I just want to also address what you said, which is that, you know, it takes a certain amount of reflection to be able to realize when, you know, you are getting heated or triggered as a speaker or as a listener or both. And so the first thing I encourage people to do in those situations when they realize that they're getting there a little bit, ironically, is to congratulate yourself on your awareness of seeing that, because a lot of people who have that level of conscientiousness that it does take to be able to be constructive criticism and notice when you're going off track, sometimes those same people can also have a very harsh inner critic. And so then when they find themselves doing it, they start beating themselves up and saying, shut up. You know, why am I sounding this way? I need to cool it. I'm sounding like a crazy person. Why am I getting so heated? You know, and they'll turn the whole experience of awareness about going off into such an unpleasant experience of awareness that they begin to tamp down that awareness, to just push it out and just not even want to acknowledge it or address it. So the first thing to do is to realize it's so much better to realize when you are getting snippy than to not realize that you're getting snippy,
for sure.
Right?
Yeah.
So, you know, first go ahead and congratulate yourself and say, wow, this is great. I'm like truly halfway there already just by being willing and able to notice this and to acknowledge it. That is truly huge. And then just a couple of other ideas that you can do. One is to imagine that you're on camera, right? Imagine that a camera is watching you and that this video is going to go viral, or that, you know, this video is going to be played for your mentor or your spouse or your kids or whomever. It's incredible what it does to people when they have a sense of being watched. There've been a study as well, even of some surgeons, and simply literally just putting a picture of eyes on the wall that just everybody knows is just a picture. The surgeons actually perform better, right? When there's like a set of eyes on you. Dr. Phil, I did his show and we talked about this too, that he felt like whenever people would come on his show and they know they're on camera, they would suddenly put on their Sunday manners and become Mr. and Miss Reasonable, right?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, yeah. Like I curse like once or twice an episode, but in real life over that period of time, it's probably 10 times that. I have an issue.
Yeah.
There's something about trying to be your best self when you know someone's watching.
Yeah. So, you know, congratulate yourself, potentially imagine a camera. Another thing just to know, and I can also share a couple more tips too, but just to put some context around it, is to know that when we get heated, if your heart rate is going above 100 beats per minute, which is totally doable when you're getting into a political, you know, argument with somebody of any kind, cognitively, we are less able to process what they are saying. So that is why, for example, people have to practice fire drills where they practice very obvious patterns of exit, because when, you know, the fire alarm's going off, so to speak, we act like a crazy person. We forget how to walk down the hall and exit the building, you know, so we like literally have to practice it. Now, we're not going to be that crazy when we're in a discussion, but we will have a certain degree of that. So just first of all, knowing you're probably not even truly hearing what the person is saying. So that leads into the next technique, a few techniques to share. One, and I love that your audience obviously is interested in mindfulness. And as a former yoga teacher myself, and my previous book had a lot to do with mindfulness and meditation. So what can also be really helpful in those moments is to, first of all, just physically try to relax your body. So take a breath in, and as you exhale, feel your heels grounding into the floor. And then on your next exhalation, imagine your jaw relaxing, and imagine on your next exhalation, your tongue relaxing. Because if we think about that phrase, chomping at the bit, it means what it says, right? Which is it's like your mouth is getting tensed up, wanting to talk. And so physically, from a top-down approach, relaxing your body and relaxing your mouth can start to cue you that it's not time to talk. Take out some of that tension. You'll also, your face will become softer and more friendly looking, so the other person will probably respond better to you. But also challenge yourself to see how many minutes in a row you can listen before interrupting. And I've done this, and I'll tell you, sometimes if I'm heated, or it doesn't even have to be like I'm heated, like I could be sitting with a client and I'm, you know, maybe frustrated that I feel like they're going in a certain pattern that I've heard before or whatever. And I feel like I want to pipe up, like, I know what to do here. Let me tell you. But yet I know that it's going to be better for the client if I let them talk it out and I let them get it out themselves. So I'll tell myself, you know, just see how many minutes I can listen here before I have to interrupt. And then I'll be surprised that it's only been like 1 or 2 minutes when I'm like, okay, I've been listening forever now. Now I'm going to say something. And right. Then I look at the clock and it's like, I've literally been listening for 1 or 2 minutes. And so that, you know, just tells me to listen longer. Another tip is to see how many questions you can ask in a row before, you know, you jump in with an assertion.
Or you could gamify it.
Yeah, well, exactly. But it also gives you a little challenge because we also, many of us have a little bit of a competitive side, and we like to think of ourselves as, you know, good listeners or whatever. And so putting any kind of a KPI, a key point indicator on that, gives us some real feedback that we want to, as you said, gamify it. And one last tip that I think is really helpful for people is from couples therapy. It's called reflective listening. And so you can do it where the other person knows you're doing it, where person A says their piece, person B just reflects it back, says, okay, so I hear you saying you believe A, B, C for X, Y, Z reasons. Is that right? And then person A either clarifies or says, yep, that's right. And then you switch roles. And that way everybody knows that they're going to get a chance to say what they want to say. And as a listener, again, you don't want to embarrass yourself by when it's your turn to recap what they said that you have no idea. You want to be like, yeah, I got it. You said A, B, and C for X, Y, and Z, right? So it gives you like a reason for that. But if for whatever reason you can't do the reflective listening technique with somebody, like it feels cheesy to pull it out and ask them to do it in the middle of a dialogue, you can just silently do it. So you just start listening, and then you know that when they stop talking, you're not going to say your piece. You're just going to say, okay, you know what? I just want to make sure I heard you. Did you say A, B, C for reasons X, Y, and Z? Is that right? Because again, the whole 100 beats per minute, not processing clearly, that reflective listening will help solve that.
So you're saying that you could do practice reflective listening even without mentioning you're going to?
Exactly. You can do a sneaky one.
You see what I just did there?
Yes, you did it.
I think those are great tips. And, you know, the act of observation of the body, that is a portal into the present moment, which could just slow you down and like check in, like what's going on here with me, and be like a pattern disruptor, you know, where you're on the edge of attacking with your next line that you've been waiting to say. And then, like you said, like, try to relax, feel your feet on the ground, notice your jaw. Like you can't be two places at once. So the act of observing the tension in your jaw brings you into the right here, right now. And, where you could take a breath and kind of recalculate your next, move, your next moment.
Yeah.
The other thing too, you mentioned about changing the mind, and unfortunately, I don't know why anybody would want to be a politician, but one thing that they all get snagged on is like a previous thing. It's they're ridiculed for changing their mind. They're punished for changing their mind. Well, 10 years ago, you said this, when really, that's what we should want. Like, we should want our politicians not to be the same person that they were 10 years ago. They should be 10 years smarter.
Totally.
And it also provides like almost a on-ramp to be compassionate for somebody, to be like, everybody's on their own journey. Like, they're where they are right now because of all the moments that led them to that and their experiences. And that's just where they are right now. And, yeah. And you could express just your energy to them more lovingly, knowing it, like you could essentially be, I don't know if there's a better word, you could just be more compassionate, knowing that that's just where they are now, and you don't know where they were before, you don't know where they're going to be down the road. And that could like diffuse maybe some of the fight or the aggression that we have towards people that we feel different about something.
Totally. I mean, there's more there too, Les, with what you're saying, a few things. So first of all, when it comes to the politicians and they want to change their mind and then they're accused of flip-flopping, like it's a bad thing, right? I just want to say on that one, the only time I do not take that quite so well from politicians is if they have changed their stance on a big issue, but they will not explain why. I think then that's when people are like, well, you're just seeing whatever's politically expeditious today without really, like, I don't think you've really changed your mind. I think you're just realizing a different talking point is popular today. But if you ask them, and I've seen it both ways. I've seen politicians be asked why they changed their stance on something, and they just give a bunch of weird non-speak double talk, and it's not satisfying to me. But if I've also seen where they've been asked why they changed their mind, and they give a reason, they say, well, I admit I was wrong. I saw this, I thought that, and then such and such an ABC happened, and I had to conclude that I was wrong. You know what I mean? Like then it's fine with me.
That would be a great way to just gain respect from people from, across multiple categories of political thought, ideologies too. Like everybody could respect somebody that does that. Today's episode is supported by one of our affiliate partners, Sunlight and Saunas, and I want to share about them in a very real and personal way. Of all the health and wellness tools I've invested in over the years, whether it be the education, the movement practices, and just the myriad of modalities. Our sunlight and sauna has honestly been the single greatest overall investment I've made for my well-being. Not because it fixes everything, but because of how consistently it supports my nervous system and my mood. I know many users of infrared saunas use it for the great cardiovascular benefits or the detoxification, which are obviously important, but for me personally, it's about how I feel. Using the sauna almost guarantees that I move through my day feeling more grounded, more regulated, and just more emotionally steady. Their full-spectrum infrared technology works at lower temperatures, which makes the experience feel more supportive rather than depleting. It's not about pushing through intense heat. It's about allowing the body to soften, to release, and to reset. For me, it's become a non-negotiable. It's an anchor in my self-care, a space to slow down, to breathe, and let my body do what it already knows how to do when it feels safe and supported. If you're someone who carries a lot, who tends to live in your head, or who's working to support your nervous system more intentionally, this is a tool that truly complements any other health-minded lifestyle habit, whether it's meditation, exercise, you name it. You can learn more about Sunlighten and explore their sauna options at sunlighten.com/mindful. They are running some of their biggest specials right now, so check them out and see which sauna is best for you. I assure you, it's an investment you won't regret. Hello, it's Les here. I want to offer my sincere gratitude to you for tuning in. I know there are seemingly infinite options to place your attention these days, and I am humbled that you chose to spend this time with me. I also want to let you know that I am opening up a few more online private coaching sessions. I've been coaching clients for over 17 years, and I've always found it very rewarding to guide someone through a transformational phase of their life. If you would like to play a larger role in your sense of well-being, feel better in your body, and support your own healing or growth journey, please check out my services at themindfulmovement.com/less to see if we would be a good fit.
Totally. And I've seen people on both sides of the aisle do it. But it also does lead into another conversational technique when we are trying to just talk to people that differ from us politically, is to ask the questions as well, to say, you know, just out of curiosity, have you always felt this way? Or did you go through a period of change? And what led to that for you? There's a way sometimes where we can go about these conversations with a goal not of changing the other person's mind, but a goal of just simply learning about, you know, why and how they feel the way that they do, and then also learning what facts are the most important to you that support that position, and then becoming curious, do I agree with you on those facts, but I just simply extrapolate something different from those same facts as I evaluate them? Or do we actually have clear factual differences? Like, you think 50% of immigrants do X, I think 80% do X, you know, and we just have different info. So it's interesting too to just become curious about it rather than persuading about it.
Yeah, that's a good point. Is there anything that you, like, what have you changed your mind about?
Yeah, thank you. That's a good question. I would say it's more for me been about coming out of the closet about things. So what started all of this for me was masking children during COVID. So I, at the time, had a 3-year-old. He's now going to be 9 this week, but we're going back to 2020, so I just can't believe how time flies. But anyway, I was living in New York, and my 3-year-old had stayed home with me throughout his life. And our plan was that as he was going to be turning 4 that year in December, we were going to put him into a preschool program for the first time. We thought that'd be good for him. And then COVID happened, and everybody had to start wearing masks. And in our particular governor situation, even he, as a 3-year-old, was going to have to wear a mask all day long. And everybody else around him was going to have to be wearing a mask all day long. at his first experience ever of being away from me for more than a few hours, you know? Crazy. I mean, except for like maybe once or twice if I took a trip and he was home with his dad or something. But, you know, it was his first time being away from us. And as a clinical psychologist, I was like, well, the whole point of us sending him there is like for social group interaction. So like this really defeats the purpose. And the school as well, they were like, yeah, Chloe, we get it. We agree with you. But like, it's the law. It's not our policy. It's the law. So I wrote, just to make sure I wasn't losing my mind, I wrote all the reasons as a psychologist why I was concerned about this, showed it to some colleagues and said, am I missing something here? Because I think this could be a real, you know, very harmful. But before I share this publicly, I just feel like I'm going to embarrass myself. There must be something obvious here that I'm missing. I was really second guessing myself. And my colleagues said, no, Chloe, this is all correct, but you should not share it publicly because it could discourage people from masking their children. And so I was like, okay, well, that's super weird because you're agreeing with me that it could cause serious harms. But anyway, so I went ahead and shared the article and started getting some very interesting reactions from various people. But most importantly, and by the way, it was retweeted by Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, who is now the director of the NIH. So that was fun. At the time, I started having some great dialogue, and parents from all over the country started DMing me and saying, you know, thank you for giving me the vocabulary to express like some stuff that I was really concerned about. So that was where it all started. And then, frankly, trans issues. I was really in the closet about that. I sit on the board of Women's Health magazine even. And frankly, I'm just waiting for them to drop me. I'm sure it's coming at any time because...
Probably later like, today.
Yeah, frankly, it could. Who knows? You know, I'm ready. You know, I love them. I want to be with them. But I do recognize, like, they put, you know, quote, trans women on the cover of their magazine, I think. And as a woman, I started to say, well, wait a minute, you know, I'm not comfortable with the idea of a man coming into my locker room just because he says he's a woman or whatever. But I kept quiet about that for a very long time because, again, I was afraid of being labeled as a bigot. I was afraid of, you know, losing my position at Women's Health or, you know, whatever it may be. I was just afraid. And so I didn't say anything about it. So it was kind of in stages for me. And then the other one, frankly, is abortion. I've always been much more on the pro-life side, but I was kind of closeted about it. Like whenever the topic would come up for me being in New York City, in circles that are, you know, really heavy with academics and journalists and media people, like when Roe v. Wade was overturned, you know, all the group chats lit up with like this automatic, like, you know, let's go to protests, blah, blah, blah. And the idea of just saying, actually, I'm happy about that. You know what I mean? It was like, I felt like I had to stay closeted. So I don't know that there's, I'm just trying to think if there's anything huge. I guess I actually have changed my mind about abortion, to be honest. I grew up with pro-life, and then I actually took on a very pro-choice mentality quite seriously and genuinely. I did some volunteer work for Planned Parenthood. I was that much of a pro-choice person. And then I went and changed my mind back again after I saw some videos of fetal development and things like that. And as well, frankly, with the trans, at first I was super chill with it. I was just like, yeah, whatever, like who cares? And then I started learning about some of the stuff that was happening, say like men being in women's prisons, like actual men that were convicted of raping women that then say they identify as a woman and then get placed into a women's prison and things like that. And I met a girl, by the way, as well. That was another big thing. I met a girl that's a college swimmer that got beat by some guys that were swimming on her college team, and it was really devastating to her. So, yeah, I guess I've changed my mind even about some of those exact issues. But for me, the difficulty was not really in changing my mind. I've always been a pretty flexibly minded person. The difficulty for me was being willing to say so publicly.
Well, it seems like you are overcoming that really well. I applaud you for that.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. You, well, it sounds like you are on the track you should be on. And you articulate things very clearly and softly. You don't come off very aggressive and in your face about it. So it's very inviting to take in the message from you.
Well, thanks. Yeah. And, you know, I just want to say as well, I've also come to realize that I want other people to be able to speak up around me. So since I wrote this book, you know, part one of the book is about the cognitive, emotional, and social benefits of free speech. So I talked a little bit about the cognitive ones, and then emotionally, when we label our emotions, our amygdala starts to relax and we have, you know, less intensity about our emotions. When I first started speaking up, to your point about the way I come across now, when I first started speaking up, I had a lot of edge to me because I had been bottling it all up for so long. It would kind of come out in fits and starts. And then the third part, the benefit of free speech is social support. Like, so we all know social support is important, but when we're not being real with people, then the quality of our social support is degraded. So as I've come out of the closet to just try to be real a little bit more about things, I've realized it's also important that I tell other people very clearly I want them to be real with me and that we don't have to agree. Because I also don't want people to feel like they can't tell me that they disagree. Because that's another thing as well about changing your mind. Part of the reason, like, you know, people say like, well, what about misinformation and whatnot? And I explain in the book, you know, Galileo was jailed for the rest of his life for saying that the Earth orbits the sun. You know, during COVID, we were told that if you get the vaccine, you know, you cannot possibly slow the spread. Or, you know, my own profession was like advising people to get lobotomies in, like, you know, the 1960s. And there's, you know, records
of
physicians.
Yeah, that's a black eye on American history right there. Yeah. Totally. Like, we're wrong all the time.
And there's a time in the 1990s that physicians would testify that cigarettes were not addictive, right? And that pregnant women could smoke them if they just used a filter. So,
or more recently, that opiates weren't addictive.
Totally. You know, the idea that like there's some expert class that once they say the magic words that the science is settled, that we're therefore not supposed to talk about stuff. And if you do, then, you know, you're a crazy conspiracy theorist. I just don't think that that's a healthy mindset for us, because it would be unfair to the experts to require that they should never be wrong, right? That would be unfair to them.
That's a good
so
point.
If we can recognize, of course, experts can be wrong, and there's many examples of it happening, then we can and should feel like we can always continue talking and learning and questioning.
Yeah, it's a good point. You know, something that came to mind, and it's linked to COVID and the masking, and a weird form of censorship that I noticed. I own a gym, like a brick and mortar gym. And when first we were shut down, but when we were allowed to reopen, I did not want to require people to wear masks. And at first I was like, I didn't care. Like, okay, we should do this. But then I've been studying like health stuff for a long time. I used to be really sick, and I kind of learned how to be my own advocate and try to figure out how to get healthy. And part of that was reading studies about all kinds of health stuff. So I spent probably like 100 plus hours on PubMed. Are you familiar with PubMed?
Of course, okay. Yeah.
And just like reading stuff, whether it's about a compound, a supplement, a hormone, or nutritional take, whatever. So when I saw the masking coming up, I went on PubMed and read studies, and there were like 5 or 6 studies about masks, and like none of them said they worked well. Like they all basically said these don't work, and one of the studies was like it may in a certain situation and a certain type of mask. So I was like, oh, but these don't work. So I was like, no, I don't want to do this. People are coming to the gym. I don't want them running on treadmills and exercising with that. I don't want to wear one. I never felt good wearing one. I hated to see any of my kids have to wear one. Like, I was pretty anti-mask, I guess. And so I got all this flack from people, from members of the gym. There were a few people in particular that were really upset and adamant about getting me to require people to wear masks. And it's like, it's an unmanned facility. So people have access card. They come and go. Like, I'm not their babysitter anyway. So what I did is I would take these studies that I found on PubMed, and I would send them to those gym members and email them to them and say, take a look at this. This is why I'm not doing it. This is not why I'm not requiring it. I never got any response from those people. And some of those people just quit the gym. A few months later, I had the same talk with my mother. My mother brings up masking. And I said, Mom, let me show you something about it. Let me teach you. So I went to get the studies to send to her. They were deleted. So, like, what an interesting way to censor. Someone went in to the public database of clinical studies. And at least, I don't know if they're back on, but removed those studies. Now, these were all done prior to COVID. It wasn't so.
Do you
wasn't
have the PDFs?
No. I mean, I could probably go back in my work email and probably find the emails that I sent to the clients. It would probably take some time, but I probably could.
But I was just curious if you sent them links or if you sent them PDFs, because, I mean, when people take stuff down, that's really frustrating.
I sent them, I guess, links. Like, I would probably just go to the website and just, like, copy the page and email it. So I guess that would be the link. But I remember going to send my mom, and I was like, I can't believe this. That I can't even find them. Like, these were not hard to find before. And it was, you know, it was a few months into it. And I was like, wow, what an interesting thing. Somebody was incentivized, ordered, told, whatever, to go in and take that stuff out.
Wrong speak, yeah.
Wrong speak,
I mean,
yeah.
So, yeah, there's this, it's interesting what you said, too, about, like, when you would speak up, you know, that people would, you know, react in a, sometimes a negative way. And I think that's a really important part of all of this. And I say this again for me as somebody that used to do a lot of what we call self-censoring. I would never say anything in the media that I thought was untrue, but I just would also not say stuff that I knew was going to get me on their naughty list.
Right.
You know, like they would ask me about the Me Too situation. And of course, I would say sexual harassment is bad, but I would never say, but, you know, also girls can make stuff up sometimes, because I knew that they didn't want to hear that side of it. And so it can seem sometimes like it's just the safer way to go is to not say anything, right? Because it is only when you say something that you're exposing yourself to people that are going to want to swat you down for saying what you said. And so it can seem like the safest thing to do is to just say nothing, which, again, I did myself for a very long time. But then I feel almost silly that it finally hit me through this research and thought that, of course, like I'm sure your audience knows what repression, suppression, and denial are, right? When we bottle things up. So when we suppress, that's when we deliberately tell ourselves, oop, don't say that. And then repression is when it starts to just happen automatically, like we've pushed it down so often that it just wouldn't occur to us to say it in the first place anymore. And then denial is when we've repressed so long as well that we start to dissociate from our own actual thoughts and beliefs about things. And people might say, well, how is that even possible? Come on.
Possible.
Yeah, but it is. And so if anyone's listening and they're wondering about that, I challenge you to think, have you ever had the time where somebody says to you, what's wrong? And you say, nothing. And like, you even mean it. And you're like, I don't even know why. I'm acting like nothing's wrong. To be honest, I don't even know why I'm in a bad mood. But, you know, and then somebody kind of pulls it out of you and helps you realize that something happened earlier the day before, whatever, that got to you. And then it feels really good when you have that heart to heart and you pull it out and you unpack it and you talk about it. And then you can be constructive about it. You can say, yeah, you know what? I think I will go have a talk with him about showing up late every single time. It's obviously starting to get to me. And so I'm going to talk about it, right? Or whatever the case may be. So, yeah, it seems like the safe route to just say nothing, but you're actually doing damage to yourself through repression, suppression, and denial. And just like we do emotionally regulate through naming our emotions and the amygdala calms down and our cortisol levels drop, all kinds of good things happen when we express ourselves. And then the opposite, when we don't express ourselves, we're literally bottling things up. The cortisol levels are rising. We're ironically becoming less rational about our thoughts, right? So we you know, I think we've all had it where maybe like some little thing that we didn't express and deal with at the time, we hold it inside until we feel ready to explode about what was a small thing.
Right.
So anyway,
and denial is like so real. It's crazy how people could go into denial. I've witnessed some like fascinating examples in my life. I mean, I used to grow weed in my bedroom, and my mother was in denial about it. It was in her house. It was a big system with lots of light bulbs. Like, you could see it from the middle of the neighborhood probably at night. And she pretended it wasn't there. And because of her own insecurities about probably feeling like a bad mother if my father found out, and that he'd be able to point a finger at her of like allowing that to happen or whatever. Like, it's just so powerful, the things that we will like hide from ourselves.
Yes, we totally can. Exactly. I mean, even like, so when somebody dies, one of the first stages of grief, of course, is denial. Or, you know, victims of abuse are often in a great deal of denial. And in both cases, when the victim of the abuse starts to come out of the denial, or the grieving person, one of the ways that they come out of denial is through language, is through telling stories about the person that right. they're grieving, and kind of realizing that it's in the past tense, or the victim of the abuse telling in plain English some stories about exactly what the abuser said or did. And there's something about saying it aloud that just helps us to be conscious of reality and helps us to be grounded. And naturally then, you know, we do feel safer and more balanced when we're not basically, it's a lot of cognitive work to keep stuff inside, to act like you're in the witness protection program, like even to yourself. It causes a lot of anxiety to bottle and stuff things down. So
yeah, and those stress hormones have far-reaching systemic effects overall on our health, not just, you know, the anxiety around it. I want to ask you mentioned something a little bit earlier. You're a yoga teacher? Was that prior to being a clinical psychologist?
Yes, it's actually what stimulated me to become a clinical psychologist. So I moved to New York City in 2001, and I was teaching yoga individual lessons because, frankly, you make more money that way individually. And in New York City, to survive, I had to really maximize, you know, my time and money outputs, right? So I started teaching individually, and, you know, the type of New Yorker that can afford and will take private yoga lessons, they're usually what psychologists call a high-functioning person. You know, they're smart, they're employed, they care a lot about their health. They're oftentimes pretty stressed out, and they have a lot of interesting stuff going on in their heads, you know. So I found it fascinating to be working with these people, and I would design yoga programs for them, as well as complementary meditation programs. Like, so if they're working on, you know, assertiveness, we do strength poses and then meditations about, you know, being assertive or whatever. And so I started getting really interested in that body-mind connection and the way the mind was working. And that's what stimulated me to get a PhD in clinical psychology.
That's interesting. What an interesting connection there. Do you still practice yoga?
Not as often as I should. I wish I did. I wish I could say I do, but I do a little bit, but it's a real cop-out. But I think that at a certain point, you do kind of take your practice off the mat and just, you know, start kind of thinking and using that yoga awareness and movement throughout your life. But that's, I say it's a cop-out because it's not really the same. I think you should do both. I wish I were doing more yoga, but no, I'm not doing a lot right now.
Well, do you do any physical activity, you think? Like exercise?
Yeah. I love to walk. I know it sounds like I love to wear a weighted vest and then
that's all the rave right now.
Yeah. I mean, I wear a Fitbit and it's incredible. I can tell with my heart rate. It's literally the same as going on an elliptical for me. If I put on a weighted vest and I do a cell phone catch-up call with a friend, because there's something about the extra, you know, physiological effort of talking, I guess, then my heart rate will go into the cardio zone.
And you're out in the Florida sun doing it.
Yeah, usually in the shade. But yeah, it's okay. I call it a triple whammy of stress relief, because you're exercising, you're getting nature, and you're getting social support all at the same time.
That's great. Yeah, I think walking is so underrated. underrated. And I mean, I also, like, I have regular weekly calls where I connect with, like, my mother or sister or something. And I generally like to take those on a walk. There is something to that. I never really put it together, but there's something to that.
Totally. Yeah. My previous book was about the healthy function of anxiety, you know, which is to stimulate preparation behaviors.
What's that?
Preparation behaviors. So for example, if you have test anxiety, closing your eyes and thinking of a beach won't actually help you. But the healthy function of test anxiety would be to stimulate you to make flashcards or write down what you think are 10 likely questions for the test and the answers. Because the thing is when we get anxious, you know, we all know that we get a little extra adrenaline. Maybe we feel racing thoughts and sweaty palms and, you know, restlessness. That what that is it's excess energy. And so the trick is just to point it in the right direction. I don't know how we got onto that, I guess, with walking. And I think that's something I talked about in the book as well, is if you're feeling restless, you know, it can help to get exercise. But
yeah, that's a good point. Like, the stress hormones are elevating in an attempt to get your energy supply to meet that demand.
Exactly.
So you have to, you have to put it somewhere. It's useful. I mean, that's interesting. Well, this has been a great conversation, Chloe. I've really enjoyed this. I think the topic, the whole free speech thing, is so important. And I'm so happy to see, I feel like the cultural tide shifting a little bit towards balance. You know, you could point to different things that were the trigger of that. But from my perspective, I'm just glad that it's happening. It gives me, like, there was a time where I felt like I lacked hope around that topic, which as a parent is like a very helpless feeling. Like, what kind of world are my kids growing up? And you're like helpless to, you have no power in fixing the world for them, if that makes sense.
Totally. My book, the second one, Can I Say That? Why Free Speech Matters and How to Use It Fearlessly, is literally devoted to my son for that exact reason. As I said, you know, when I was growing up, you know, nobody ever was like afraid to express their political opinion. Like, we might argue, but nobody was going to be like canceled or anything. And I wanted him to know, my hope is that he'll grow up in that same type of a world. Like a true safe space is one where people can say what they really think, you know, that's what that is.
All right. Yeah. Now it's more important than ever. I mean, now there's such a larger percent. There used to be 0%. Now there's so many people that use these really remarkable technological platforms to create their goods and services, to create their value in exchange for their paycheck. And it can feel so like fragile and vulnerable, where like one wrong word and it could just, you could be erased. It's like, it's not good for anybody. And it's not good for the people doing the erasing either. They might think it is, but it's not.
Exactly. That's part of the reason I wrote the book, is because I wanted people as well to have a way to kind of answer back. Like, if somebody tries to say like, well, hey, we're going to not allow such and such or such and such to be said because we're trying to protect people's mental health, I want people to answer back and say, hey, actually, it's really best for our mental health if we can express ourselves authentically, even if we disagree, that we can be peaceful and respectful of each other, that there's value in that. So thanks again for giving me the chance to share that today.
Sure. It's been an absolute pleasure. And so your book, Can I Say That? Where do they find that? Is that on Amazon? Or?
Yeah, it's everywhere that books are sold. All of my books, thankfully, are available everywhere books are sold.
For
but
now.
The easiest, I'm sorry?
For now. Until.
Yeah, for now. But the easy way as well is to just go to freespeechtoday.com. At freespeechtoday.com It'll take you to my website, which is drchloe.com, but I know that's too hard for people to spell. I totally get it. So if you just go to freespeechtoday.com, you see links to all my books and all my social media, so you can connect with me any which way that you want.
And do you still practice as a psychologist with people, or just...
In a very limited capacity. I have a contract with a law firm, and so I'll see some of their lawyers sometimes, and once in a while I'll see a private client. But I'm pretty busy with speaking for the book and life otherwise. So pretty limited on the private practice right now.
Okay. Well, thanks again for reaching out. And I really enjoyed our talk today. And for the listeners, always grateful for your listening. And I guess I could encourage you. I mean, if there's something that you feel like you're not comfortable speaking about at work or whatever, around family or friends, you know, maybe find a strategy that allows you to grow out of that and see what unfolds for you, and maybe it'll improve your mental health and those around you and set a better example for the people that you care about in your life.
Yes, I'm sorry. I just realized I should say, if they do want to come to freespeechtoday.com, I am also collecting emails so I can have free groups. I had one or two already where people just practice talking about free speech. So if people want to do that, they can come and try to sign up for that. It's free.
That's a great idea. We'll link to that in the show notes description. I appreciate that. Yeah. And if you're a listener and you have something to share about an experience you've had dealing with something like this, then please share it so the community can learn. Thanks again. And I hope you all have a great day.
Thanks.